Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to SFF Addicts. Today's episode of the podcast is an author panel from TBRCon 2022, a virtual literature convention run by FanFi Addicts David Walters, with a focus on science fiction, fantasy, and horror. What you're about to listen to is just one of the panels from the convention that I'll be publishing here on the SFF Addicts podcast feed. Mind you, I won't be uploading all of the panels as there are a lot, 24 in total. So if you're aching for more, head over to the FanFi Addict YouTube channel to see full video of each and every one. And if you can't catch a panel live, don't worry. They will be available there from now until YouTube's demise. Also, TBRCon is available to stream live every day until January 30th, 2022 on the FanFi Addict Twitter account, Facebook page, or YouTube channel. So for more information on the convention, including the full schedule of panels and more, head over to fanfiaddict.com/TBRCon-2022. I'll also include all links in the show notes for your convenience. All right, now on to the panel. Here we go.
Good morning and welcome to TBRCon 2022. My name is Beth Habler from Before We Go Blog and Grimdark Magazine, and I have the immense pleasure of hosting the Norse Fantasy panel today. And if we could have everybody just introduce themselves, that'd be great. Taya, go ahead.
So I publish as TL Greylock. My name is Taya, however, and I don't answer to TL. So I have a Norse trilogy that was my first series I published. It's called The Song of the Ash Tree. It starts off with The Blood-Tainted Winter. Currently, I'm working on book three, well, supposedly working on book three of The Godforged Chronicles, which the first book is an SPFBO finalist this year.
I'll go next. I am DW Ross, but you can just call me D-Dubs today. My real name is Ross, so it's kind of like Taya, so don't call me DW, please. I'm the writer of the Onyxborn Chronicles, currently two books out, The Cold from the North and The Darkest Dusk. Third book coming out in a couple of months, hopefully. Pleasant to be here.
Which way are we moving?
I don't have everybody's book, by the way.
Genevieve, why don't you go ahead?
Hi, I'm Genevieve Gornicek. I'm the author of The Witch's Heart, which came out this past February. It's a reimagining of Norse mythology centering an obscure side character, the giantess Angerbola. And I'm working on something else that I can't speak of yet because publishing, but it is Norse adjacent, so.
Okay. Tamandra?
My
order, it's gotten out of order.
Yeah, it's just around.
Tilda, go ahead.
Okay, I'll go ahead then. I'm Tilda Colt-Hold. I am the author of Northern Wrath and Shackled Fates in the Hancock trilogy, with the third one coming out later this year. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm Tamandra Mike-Aspel. You can call me Tim for short, it's no problem. I actually wrote a grimdark romance trilogy first, and I've recently published Queens of the Weird, which is a Norse-inspired, Viking mums go on a badass adventure and save the world.
Sounds great.
Ryan, you're next.
Ryan.
I've had a whirlwind of a morning. my name's Ryan Cahill, but Cahill if you can't pronounce it. So nobody seems to pronounce it, either from the US, the UK, Australia, or New Zealand, which I currently am. It's 5 a.m. here, and I can't find my laptop charger, but I'll be here as long as I'm alive, my battery. I'm still not really prepared now because my brain's all of fuzz. But I released my first book of Blood and Fire in March, and my second book... then a novella after that 2 months later, and then my second book in December just gone there. So,
awesome. I just want to remind the audience that if you have questions during the panel, go ahead and ask them, and I will pause our questions as we go along and pop them in there. So let's dive in. And for the uninitiated, what is Norse fantasy and how do we recognize a Norse fantasy story versus one based on, say, Greek myth? And whoever wants to start, just go ahead and jump in.
Nobody's drinking olive oil.
More accents in the Norse stories.
Yeah, first time.
Do they drink coffee?
I'll start by saying that I think that for me, Norse mythology really encompasses a combination of pessimism and hopefulness that you don't see elsewhere. I think when I think of Greek mythology, I think of the gods kind of capering around and messing with the mortal world, and they're having fun, and there aren't necessarily, I mean, there are consequences, especially for the mortals. It's very bad for the mortals, but in terms of bigger picture consequences, those aren't necessarily there. And I think when you go Norse mythology, you see kind of a bleakness, but also looking ahead to the future as best they can.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, going off on that, I think there's definitely a lot of humor in the Norse mythology as well. There's a lot of things to laugh at. There's always a joke, if not at the end and in the middle on several of them. And I think that really comes through in a lot of Norse literature, that there is a kind of lightheartedness about things.
Not taking themselves so seriously.
Exactly. Life is life, and you got to have fun while you're in it, right? And you got to leave a good legacy, of course, but you also got to enjoy it.
And I think part of that is that, you know, they had this expectation of the afterlife. Like, you know, you always in like Norse fiction, it's like death and Valhalla, but like there's also this humor and aspect of it.
Like, I think when you go to anything kind of Greek inspired, you go like Teo as well, you go back through like the Iliad and the Odyssey, and it's all about epic, heroic scope, and everything is so serious. It is like, but I mean, you come to Norse and it is. But like, is that lightheartedness? It's that kind of, it's heroic, but it's not in this epic, grand, I'm going to write a book about it scope. It's that kind of down in the dirt, get it done. It's just the scope of it is quite different, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, do you think it's like, I was going to jump in after and say, I feel like it feels more real. Like it feels more relatable and less fantastical, yeah. If that makes sense, whenever I see or read anything that's not inspired.
For me, like, you can think of like five or six heroes off the top of your head in Greek fiction, but in Norse, it is about the gods and it is about Valhalla, but it's about the individual in the dirt. For me, like it's the single person every single time, and I think it is more real for me anyway.
But I would just say, I think at the same time, the fact that we can all name six or seven Greek heroes off the top of our heads is also a distinguishing factor, because in Norse mythology, yes, there is an emphasis on the individual, but we don't know those individuals, which I think makes it pretty unique.
Yeah.
Okay.
But don't we? Okay. I mean, like we have the sagas with the with the specific heroes being named. So, I don't know. I'm listening to all of these, and I'm like, yes, but. There's also this element that we have like bits and pieces. So I'm not exactly sure how comprehensive, because I'm not an archaeologist and I haven't done like ancient Greek history, but like how many holes we have. But like the Norse mythology that we do have is very, like it comes in fragments and stories of stories and bits and pieces of oral, you know, culture that were handed down later in times. So it's like there's bits there that you can take as canon, but you can also just like do so much with it because there are these like massive holes that you can just step in. Because that's the other question is like, is Norse inspired always based on Norse mythology? I'd say no, because it's like it's got a specific world building feel as well.
Completely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think even my book, I think my books are probably the least Norse here. Mine are definitely more Norse adjacent, but they're definitely Norse inspired. And it is a lot of it is not just from the gods and mythology, but from the feel of that world. And like Taya said at the start, it's that the realistic kind of feel of it and the way they approach it, and even just the types of armor you might use or the way you might speak, or it's a whole different feel. If you go down to the just bare bones of it, they just feel different. They feel very different, the world, when you read.
Culturally, it's quite different as well, so that might account for some of it, right? The cultural differences. Greeks and Norse people are definitely not seeing eye to eye culturally all the time.
The same.
Yes, sure, yeah. There are things that are similar, and they do have, you can equate some of the gods to some things, but it's
not a completely just
different way of looking at the world, of looking at, current life and the afterlife as well.
Yeah.
If I could just go back to what Tim said about sort of the gaps and the holes in Norse mythology as it exists for us today. So this is stepping into the Greek realm, because I actually have I'm sort of an archaeologist, and I did my...
Just flexing there. She's just like...
Yeah, but I did my thesis on the myth of Theseus, and I did it looking at the pottery. And so we have a material evidence for Greek myths that we don't have in the same way for Norse. And I wrote specifically about the evolution of Theseus's myth over time, over centuries of time, as the changes you can see in the stories are depicted on pottery in different ways. And so I do think it's really important to note, like Tim said, that we have a different sort of material culture evidence for Norse stuff. And in part of that is, a lot of what is written down, it was written down centuries later by Christian monks and stuff like that. So that makes a big difference.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. It seems like religion and the belief in gods go hand in hand with the fantasy genre in general. What purpose do they serve in fantasy?
How much time do you have?
We have an hour and 30 minutes.
Well, actually, I'm going to correct you there, because I might only get maybe an hour out of my laptop. I suppose because I spoke up, and now I'll stack.
It's going to have to, man.
I think gods play like an innumerable amount of roles. One of the very few I find, if you go into especially military inspired fiction, like they provide a purpose. They provide what's the easiest role of gods in history is just to provide a reason to do something. Like you follow something, and therefore you have a creed, which is probably the most dangerous thing a single individual can ever have, because they have a reason to kill someone that absolves them of any real repercussions or moral repercussions in their own head. But that's, for me, one of the main driving factors with gods is it provides a purpose and something to worship, and therefore provides a structure for your whole society. And that tends to be the way, if you look at Greek and you look at Norse mythology, like it's in Valhalla, and you look at Odin and Thor, and people will do things for glory for their gods. They will do it because that's what they believe they should do. It provides a belief system that allows you to kind of move forward and structure, be it a war-based culture or anything similar. There's obviously 100 different ways that God can influence anything, but I think for me that's the first thing that comes to my head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true.
On you go, Tilda.
Okay, I was just going to add that the thing about fantasy is that in fantasy you actually get to write the gods, so the gods get to come alive. Because this is true for everyone, right? Our religion, yes. What we believe in, shape who we are, how we think, why we do things. That's true, no matter what we're talking about. But in fantasy, we actually get to see the gods up close. And sometimes our characters get to interact with the gods, and we get to see them being surprised that their gods act as they do and not as they thought they might. So that's quite an interesting twist on it, that they get to be confronted by their own beliefs, quite literally, that we don't see in other genres.
Yeah, that's kind of exactly what I was thinking as well. It's what it is, because it's like the gods in mind. Like at first I was like, I wanted them to be behind this curtain, and then I was like, no, this is cool. I can actually play with these characters and give them personalities and their own lives and things, and then that just adds weight to the story. And like, no spoilers or anything, but there will be like, I don't know, crossing the fourth wall or whatever, but there will be like moments where characters get to meet these gods and interact with them. And I would say that that's something I'm probably most excited about exploring now that I've kind of, I don't know, worked up the courage to do it, like to actually give them a face and a name and everything. So So yeah, and I think going back to what Ryan said as well, like having the gods in my book kind of gave me the purpose for each character to do what they're doing, effectively making them pawns to a bigger thing, if that makes sense. Yeah. And that's something I really liked, stealing from Norse stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I quickly, when I started writing Northern Wrath and Shackled Fates, they actually started as historical fiction. But I very quickly realized that I couldn't write about the Vikings without also writing like all their beliefs were true, because it was such a big part of who they were and why they did what they did. So I had to take that seriously. And naturally, the gods started coming in. And as soon as you have gods on the page, you're in the fantasy realm. So that's kind of how it happened, because I couldn't separate their culture from their gods.
Everything just scopes up as well. As soon as you bring gods in, everything, as soon as you you take it from the observing god to the active god, anything can happen. The whole world just explodes. It's a pretty cool thing to explore.
That's, I would say that's a big piece of it for what I did in my series, because I'm not overly, I don't spend a lot of time creating magic in my fantasy. And so the gods automatically give you that element and allow you to explore without having to explain everything, which I personally really enjoy.
Little question about it for you all. What do you think about the Norse gods and how human they are, how mortal in a way they are and they act? What are your thoughts on that compared to other gods? Because when we say gods in general, we tend to think of this, most people think of this figure that's just all powerful, can do anything, is above everyone.
Yeah.
Norse gods are very human in a way.
Yeah,
I think as soon as you approach polytheism, you have that kind of realness in gods, because I think it's that singular god. Like if you go like the Christianity and the God and Allah, and it's a singular god, and it usually doesn't have a personality. But when you create polytheism, it's almost like people want to personify them. And I think it's fantastic. It's a great way of bringing all these different facets into religion. Personally, but
for me, it goes back to
what we were saying about Irish, so I'll keep talking.
For me, it goes back to what we were saying about it feeling more real. I think it's something I can relate to a bit more, because it isn't just one face, one name kind of thing. It is those different kind of personalities and traits that I think we, as you go through life, you realise not everything is just straight and narrow. So it does help, I think, and it makes it more relatable.
And the fact that they can die and they do make mistakes, my story is just all gods and creatures and stuff. So like there's no interaction with humans really. So I got to, you know, do the whole thing, but with just these characters. And it was like fascinating, like getting to know them a little better and kind of putting your own spin on things.
Do you think your approach would have been different if they had been real people that you were trying to convey? Like if the stories had been told as sagas and you were trying to retell that instead of knowing that they're gods?
That's a great question. When I finish this next book, I'll let you know, because I'll probably have a different answer.
Oh, okay.
I read a really great...
Please go ahead. I wanted to say what Jean-Vive just said. I think that's it was going through my mind, but I don't know, I wasn't sure how to articulate it, but it's like this, you know, that the gods are mortal. Like if you look at so we all know like Ragnarok and the end, you know, of that system of things and the system, the belief system. But it's like the entire time the gods are aware of the fact that they are going to die. And it's fascinating where that comes from as well, but it's just like you know how they say God made men, or the gods made the men, but the men also make the gods. So it's like the way we think about things is how we, you know, construct our own sort of like deities. And I love the fact that apparently for a lot of like Norse and Germanic people, it was like, yes, these are nature gods. And of course, just as we see in nature, they're as mortal as we are, so they can die. You know, so I think what Ross said with it makes it real, because it's more human. Mm-hmm. So yes, you have the epic, but you also have the, you know, the I'm a fallible human, I make mistakes kind of thing. That's great.
I actually also never would have thought about it like that before.
Fantasy. Mind blowing. Yes.
But it's one of the few, like you use the word pantheons, where gods have to face their own mortality, and that changes your dynamic entirely. If it's like it's explored in like every book and every film, is that, you know, people always want to stop death, but once you stop death and you're immortal, your whole outlook on life changes because your reason for existing changes. So that's actually really interesting. I'd never thought about it like that, because when it's the first pantheon of gods that really face their own mortality, it kind of explains exactly why they do act the way they do and why they have that kind of personification and myth, which is, yeah, their mind is blown. Yeah.
You're welcome.
This really leads into another question that I have. I read a great quote about the Viking religion, that they don't seek salvation, but instead they marvel, acknowledge, and praise attempts to master it by accomplishing great deeds for the benefit of oneself and one's people. You know, so it's, as you say, it's down in the dirt, you know, and they're constantly marveling at life. Do you have any favorite examples of a story that showcases that idea best?
I would say, to start relatively basic, for me, the very fact that they know the end of the world is coming and they know what that looks like. And I think Odin in particular, as the sort of chief god, he has, he's fighting against it even though he knows it's pointless. And I think that that sets a foundation for a lot of other stories in small ways, in that sense that, like, you might, if you accept fate or not, regardless of what your views on fate are precisely, you're still going to act the way you want to act, and you're going to fight for what you believe in, even if you know it might be hopeless.
What Taya said.
Yeah.
But it is, I think it's also, again, I know I keep going back to it, but it just makes everything so relatable. Like, everybody that I know, especially people my age, get up and, like, life's a struggle. Do you know what I mean? There's no other way to put it. People go through things, and it's not always easy to get up day after day. And, like, if people go through things, it's hard. But I think that's what does make it, like, you are kind of, is it ingrained in us, maybe, to just keep pushing for something better? I think so. I hope so. So, yeah, again, I'm just like a one-note joke here, just going back. It's relatable. But honestly, that's, I think, what draws me to it, is just knowing that there is an inevitable end and that time is precious. I think it's kind of a lot of the stories that I've read that are Norse, that seems to be like the overarching theme. And I do think that's probably the most special thing for me to them, is that escape from books and stories and tales, but the hope that comes with it.
I can't not laugh, not at you, Dave. You said something really nice and succinct, but the scene popped into my head when we portray the idea of portraying the gods as mortal and living life. And it came into my head that even in movies now, even in Marvel cinema, when you go and you see the Greek gods and the Norse gods, okay? And you go back, and even Marvel and DC, and you go back and the Greek gods and Zeus is there, and you have Heracles, and they're all mighty and strong. And then you go to Marvel, and it just has the scene of Thor talking about Loki, and he's like, "And you know, I picked up a snake, and Loki knows I love snakes." And then he just, it wasn't a snake. But that's it for me. That's like, it just shows. That's like, even though obviously that is complete, you know, but it's that level of. Even the same people portraying the different pantheon of gods, when they portray the Norse gods, it's fun and it's joking. And, you know, Thor is the most powerful characters you will ever see in it. And he has so much potential. But like at the start of the thing, all he's doing is drinking. Like, he is just living life. At the very first film, he goes in, gets a beer, drinks it in the cafe, and smashes it on the ground and says another. And it's just, you don't see the Greek gods ever portrayed that way. Like, the closest you get is the fact that everybody realizes that Zeus is the biggest misogynist that ever existed. That's like the closest it comes. but I think that's it's a really obviously a very silly example for me compared to and yours, but that's where my head goes.
It's probably because now my head goes to Fat Thor sitting eating pizza. So Fat Thor sitting eating pizza is like my favorite Marvel moment. So yeah. If you can portray the strongest, most mighty god and all of that kind of pantheon is just sitting in a little shack in Scotland eating pizza,
yeah,
and arguing with like a New Zealand man made of rocks or whatever it was,
yeah,
then yeah, I mean, count me in, I'm gonna watch it.
But that still feels like Thor though,
yeah.
Like it's still just so fascinating to me that like so many people have reinterpreted the gods in so many different ways, and some of them you agree with it, some of you don't, but the vibes are still there. Like I can see mythological Thor eating pizza like playing video games with a rock man. So
he's
like
a really powerful 18-year-old.
Yeah,
I just, and he knows I love snakes. Classic Loki.
I do think Fat Thor was one of the greatest Marvel moments ever.
No, yeah, just... that specific scene, and apparently I heard a while ago that was like almost all improv, and it just broke my mind.
the big Lebowski scene.
Yeah.
So great.
I love life.
As a writer, what drew you specifically to Norse fantasy? And what is the best part of it for you?
I can jump in first because my answer is really simple. What drew me to it first is that I was born in Scandinavia. I was raised in Scandinavia and I moved away when I was a bit older. And I did not feel a connection to Denmark, the place where I was born, later on. Culturally, I didn't feel it. And searching for kind of a connection to the place where my parents were from, to the place where I had grown up, I went into the history. And in the Vikings, I find something that I can connect to. I find that's my culture. That's what I think of when I think Denmark. That's the Denmark I want to take with me. And so that's really how I got interested. And then, you know, the stories are just so fun. How can you not want to write about it?
Similar, my grandfather was from Sweden and I got the opportunity to study abroad in Sweden when I was in college. And I came back, did a Scandinavian studies minor, and that was it. Like that was, I had read some of the Norse myths like as a child because I was super into mythology, but I didn't start really connecting with them until I was an adult and started like, kind of like I got to translate some of them like from the original poems, and that was super cool. But just like being able to engage like on like an academic level and kind of get to dig deeper was how I got into it.
Oh,
but it started
cool.
In Sweden.
I think mine is like a base answer. Like I was just super interested in, to be honest, the look was one thing, the battle type was another thing. I grew up in Scotland and we have like a really, really rich history about battles and being like a kind of Celtic background of people, how we were kind of scrappy and everything. I did kind of relate that to like Norse mythology, Vikings and things like that at first, but then in digging deeper you realise that they were actually like, I would say, one of the first battle-ready people, if that makes sense. They were always ready for battle, they were always trained, that kind of thing. They knew exactly what they were doing. And that bit was what drew me in. And I think that's where my initial character was just a kick-ass guy with an axe. And then it kind of just kind of snowballed from there. But it was that that definitely drew me to like Norse mythology, Norse culture and Vikings and things like
I
that.
I like fighting.
Yeah. I am bred to fight. I'm Celtic blood. I don't know. Vikings, give me stuff.
I'm from Ireland. The Vikings came to us. They came to the coast. They raided us. They kind of just eventually seeped into us, and then most of them left with their boats, but quite a few of them stayed.
Quite a few, yeah. I'm the exact same. Like west coast of Scotland was another place that was. We've got places like down in Largs and things where you can go, and they tell you the bits that are like influenced and inspired, or just places that were settlements and things, and definitely spurred my interest.
I'll give you a fun fact. So, like, I'm just skipping ahead here, but when they came to Ireland, and where I'm from in Dublin. Is actually called, the reason it's called Dublin is it comes from Dove Lynn, because when the Vikings got here where the pool was, they called it Black Pool, and Dove is black and Lynn is pool, so in Irish, so that's how much they're here. They're named everywhere.
It's class.
This is Black Pool, and then like 100 years later, it's still Black Pool. Yeah.
Yes, I love that we have the same kind of, because I mean, so I'm half British, half German. My dad's British and my mom's German. So it was always like half of the Germanic, you know, there was, I mean, obviously the Germanic flavor of Norse mythology is a little bit different than like true Norse. But that makes it interesting because you have the same, you know, how much is Wodan as we understand him actually the same as Odin? What's the regional, you know, flavor? And so that's, it was incredibly easy to use because I just had to go back to all of the stuff that I already know, which is, as you know, as an author, you don't want to make up every single thing. It's like, no, I know this, I can do this. It's something I can riff off in my sleep, basically. But it's also like the huge freedom. It's there's an expansiveness to world building, like especially due to the seafaring culture and the way, you know, that it's not just in Norway and it's not just Scandinavia. It's like, you know, you have the north of Germany, you have the Netherlands, you have a lot of parts of Britain, and it's all sort of like Iceland, Greenland, you know. So it's like there's this huge map that you already have and that you can use when you're building your fantasy world.
Like Tim, I kind of came to Norse mythology through Germanic mythology. I was a strange child and I watched a lot of opera, and I watched Wagner's Ring Cycle when I was too young to understand what was going on.
Classic.
But, I came back to it as a teenager, like right before I went off to college, and suddenly I was like, oh, this is really cool. Like, I appreciated the stories when I was younger, but didn't understand it enough to really appreciate what was going on. So a little later, I came back to it, and I think a lot of what drew me in was, in those operas, the character of Wotan, who, you know, is essentially Odin, he exhibits so much humanity while also being incredibly powerful. And I think that was like sort of the key thing that brought me into that world. And then because I do also have Scandinavian heritage, I was like, oh, I want to know more. So that took me on a spiraling path into that.
Am I the only one with a Scandinavian heritage or Germanic heritage?
I don't know.
I know the difference, but
yes. I think I'm just Scottish. I'm like 99% Iron Brew.
That's okay. I'm 99% sarcasm, so it works out.
See, just to touch on something that Tim said, another thing that really, really drew me was one of the kind of world settings I've always loved is fjords, mountains, low plains, valleys. And I think seeing shows and seeing like things, just nature in general in Scandinavian countries, that definitely drew me more towards, oh, why is this land like that? Why does this look so fantastical? Why does this look so mythical? Even though it's just like the world, if that makes sense. But that was like a huge part.
I was fortunate enough to visit Norway when I was drafting my trilogy. I think I went in 2014, so I was basically in the middle of my 18 months of drafting those three books, and just being able to see the fjords in person and the mountains and the way that landscape interacted with itself, because it's like, oh, I know what mountains look like, I know what fjords look like, but then really seeing it in person brought it into a light that I couldn't quite imagine as well as I would want to, and that I think made a huge difference moving forward when I was able to put those descriptions into my books.
Just when you see some things in those areas of the world where you're like, that's not possibly natural because it's so amazing, if that makes sense. And you don't really get it a whole lot of places, but it seems like it's vast and there's a lot of it out there.
That actually leads into a really good question. The Norse mythos is deeply connected with the land. How do you create that connection in world building?
Personally, I think that the culture and the gods stem from the landscape. Like, the way that you go about things really stem from where you are physically. And for the Vikings, in part, you know, Norway, things like that with the big mountains, you're not going to be able to farm those mountains as well as you're going to be able to farm different kind of land. When you go further south in Scandinavia, you don't have the mountains, meaning parts of Sweden and all of Denmark. It's just islands. There's water everywhere. Where are you going to go when you run out of farmland, right? There's only one way to go, and that's the ocean. Mm-hmm. So that naturally makes them seafarers. And if you got to go into those fjords, you got to have ships that are able to navigate in those kind of waters and are able to navigate at sea. So that drives your technology that way, which also drives your lust for adventure, you wanting to go out and discover what's beyond, what's out there, what else, what other islands are out there. So I think that really, it all stems from the landscape. And even though the south of Scandinavia and the north of Scandinavia is quite different in terms of looks, you know, one has mountains, the other has none whatsoever. They're all surrounded by water and very isolated. One is isolated by the mountains, mm-hmm. so unable to communicate across those big ridges, and the other is isolated by the water. So in either case, you have to go by the waterways, and that kind of ends up building your culture.
I think for me, go ahead, Tim. I'm very conscious that I'm a very loud individual and you seem very lovely and well-spoken and I'm just going to keep talking, so I need to just go.
Well, maybe you can expand on what I'm about to say. It's like, I think the quote that Beth had earlier about the awe and the wonder is something that when you see that in the natural landscape, it's something that sort of like comes up again and again, this connection with nature. And I was specifically thinking of like, because I remember thinking about this like when I was writing Queens of the Weird, because my main character is like, she's a giant, so a Jotun, and comes from Jotunheim originally. But it was like, but what do the giants actually represent? Well, you know, they're like, they're chaotic. They're not actually evil. They just, because they cannot, you know, because they're so powerful and they have all this natural, you know, the elements and the cold and the winter. And, you know, it's like, it's killing because nature kills sometimes. Yes, you have the awe and the wonder and the, wow, this looks so incredible because I'm a 21st century adventurer and I'm very safe, you know. But back then, it's like, the sea can kill you, the mountains can kill you, the ocean can kill you, the storm can kill you, the thunder can kill you, you know. So it's like, it's this this aspect of, yes, this is glorious, beautiful nature, but it's also deadly, or it can be very deadly. And to the people of that time, it must have seemed like an unstoppable force. And so I think this connection with the land and you know, something like awe-inspiring or like nearly magical, that's something that's so innate in Norse mythology, and that makes it so rich to take on as a fantasy author, because you're always like, how do I do the world building? And then, you know, the world building is incredibly easy because you can say, well, you know, this world is populated by all these natural forces, but they're called giants, or they're called gnomes, and they're called, you know, I always forget the little Swedish house spirits. There's a name.
Tomtar.
Never mind.
But
probably in the German.
There's a lot of different ones. but I think that's a great point. And also building off that, like, even though, you know, the gods and the giants are at odds in the myths, like the gods still end up needing things from the giants. They still need that connection with the wilderness and with the wild. And so that, I think that's to your point, like it is intimidating. It is like this awe-inspiring, magical thing, like the landscape. And it can hurt you, but it can also help you, and you do rely on it for your livelihood. So, yeah.
I think that's also epitomized by the story of the creation of the landscape being that it came from a giant. I mean, it didn't come from a god body, it came from a giant body, which brings a wildness to it, but also like a little bit of humanity to it. So the landscape and the world is a character as much as anybody else's, I think.
Yeah, and I think, like, I know in my book, something I've tried to explore is that there's essentially six main gods. They go across the whole continent, but with each continent you go to, and the different people in the different worlds, they see them different ways. which is something I always wanted to explore, is when you come to the Norse area, the gods are depicted a different way because they're in a more harsh environment. The things they need to survive are different, and the way they look and what they worship and what they ask for is different. So when they depict gods in statues, they look different. When they talk about them, they're for different reasons. There can be general things that go through, like one of them could be, you know, the one who welcomes people after death, but whether she is kind or whether she is cruel depends on where you are in the world. And it's something that, for me, like when I come to the Norse-inspired areas, they're the gods are kind of viewed as more real, tougher, kind of more harsh. And I come over to, when I come to essentially who are my dwarves, who they worship as the leads of the pantheon completely changes depending on their needs. So they don't always have, say, the Zeus as the head of the pantheon because Zeus does nothing for them. So they switch it around and change it. And for me, it always depends on the landscape. And that's something that particular question is something I wanted to really explore in mine, because I went very kind of Tolkien-esque, and I have elves. Not all of them in any way are exactly the same as what you'd be used to, and it'll keep changing as I go forward in the books, and I have different races. But what I wanted to do was go, you know, do the dwarves see their gods as dwarves, or do they see them depicted as humans due to the way the culture has impacted them over the years and that kind of thing? So I think, yeah, like your environment massively affects it all. It's a kind of small little detail that's, you know, maybe I have like kind of like the iceberg theory. So there's this much shows in the book, and then I have all this in the background. Go, oh, I'm exploring the shit out of this. Right. Yeah.
Okay.
That got awkward. Quiet. Point it out when it's not awkward.
Norse fantasy has gotten very popular in the last 20, I'd say about 20 years or so. What do you think has started its renaissance, for lack of a better word?
So many reasons. One of the biggest ones that I can see really obviously, which definitely isn't just it, but when big movies and TV shows pick up something, mm-hmm. it goes crazy. One of the biggest shows that's happened in the last 10 years is Vikings. Yep. And even before then.
Marvel. Yeah.
Marvel has probably one of the biggest cinematic scopes in the world in regards to how many people watch it. And you bring in Thor. And yep. then they go, oh, everyone likes Thor. So we're bringing in Loki and Odin, and we're getting deep and down into them. And I think that's been massive. That's been huge. The amount of Viking-based shows, and even you go the other one, is it Bernard Cornwell's books? The Last Kingdom, was quite big as well. And all of that is all Viking influence. They're exploring different, totally different aspects of it. One is very realistic, not realistic, but it's based off history a bit more tightly. And you're going through when you go to Wessex and they go through kind of the British history, whereas Vikings obviously is technically based off history with Ragnar Lothbrok, but not as much. All of it did happen, but I think there's less when you kind of focus in on this one person who is, you know, there's a bit more going on there, but it's still very, very, very cool. But I think that's been massive, hugely influential in people's mm-hmm. uptake in kind of Norse literature, because their society works visually first, and then they kind of go, I want more of this.
Yep, and all of these things kind of happened around the same time too. Like Game of Thrones, Vikings, Marvel's Thor all came out, I think, 2011, 2012. So like, it was this sudden like influx of Norse fantasy, medieval.
It kind of coincided things. With this kind of revival and rebirth of fantasy, and I mean more in a cinematic realm. It's always been there, but I think if you even see now, look at Netflix, look at Amazon, all they're doing is soaking up fantasy. They're just taking stories and producing them again and again and again and again at the minute. I think, the last 10 years, I think Norse has just happened to be one of those ones that's really, really jumped with just a bit of luck and a few different things that have happened. But I think fantasy itself, from a cinematic perspective and what people take up, has just jumped massively in the last 10 years.
I think I think as well there was like a big gap in the market, because I remember growing up, like, everything was like medieval. Do you know what I mean? It was in England, and you had like your Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, you had like Braveheart, Kingdom of Heaven, like it was all that kind of same period. I think they'd kind of done it to death, where you were seeing like every third or fourth month there was a new movie with a crusader on the front of it, and I think people just got bored and they just needed something new. And I think even what Ryan was saying as well, I think it got thrust in front of us in such massive channels. Like, I remember even the title, like Thor Ragnarok, how many people would have known the word Ragnarok existed, never mind what it meant, before mm-hmm. you plastered it in front of like a whole multi-generation popular kind of series, and then the next thing people get hooked and inspired and interested. So yes, I think there was definitely a big gap in the market, and I think it's probably one of the coolest pieces or parts of history that you can look into. I think there's a whole lot of like diverse things.
Just as a pop in there, my laptop might die and I'll just switch to my phone so I could pop out and pop back in again, because my life is a shambles, and it's search for a laptop charger at 5 a.m. when everyone's asleep. But just in case I disappear, it's not because I'm running away.
Just building off of what Ross said about kind of the historical aspect of it, I think there are two key elements of historical accuracy that have kind of become more prevalent in our general consciousness, I think. One is that the Vikings went everywhere, and they, you know, went to Constantinople, and I think that people, maybe it's a combination of all these properties and stuff like that becoming popular, but I think it's that explorer element and the impact they left behind in all these places mm-hmm. that we are more aware of now than we used to be. And then specifically an example of that is the fact that we're more aware now that that Norse explorers went to not just Greenland, but, you know, Nova Scotia and Newfoundland and stuff like that. So I think that element of historical accuracy, which is also really exciting and fantastic, I think kind of helps build onto why we like them so much.
Sure. I view the Norse like I view the Irish. There's more of them everywhere else than there is back home.
the book that got me interested, did you guys ever read Eaters of the Dead?
No.
That title's going to scare a lot of people.
I think it's a Michael Crichton book, and it's based on the legend. It had I think he's an Arabic explorer come to a Viking band, and then he learns the language. You know what I'm talking about? And he learns the language.
Der 13. Krieger, it's called the 13th War. There's also a movie. There's Antonio Banderas. What's his name? Ibn Fayyad? I'm not sure.
Somebody put it in the comments. Somebody knows.
13th Warrior is based on Ibn Fayyad.
I've seen that on Netflix, it comes up. Things you should watch.
That's a retelling then of a real historical event, right?
Yes. We're
on the same page.
His depictions of the ones that he was with are what we have now. A lot of the stories of what we have now about how Vikings were then. That makes sense.
A lot of the contemporary sources are from Arabic sources, from what we have. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's things written down much, much later by the people. So we're trying to look at them at the time that they were actually there, then that's probably the sources, the literary sources that we can point the most towards.
That's what got me interested. Just wondering if you guys had read that. I think that we can agree that Thor is as close to the actual myth as, you know, Santa Claus is to Krampus. And how does an author walk the line between representing a historically accurate myth and the popular Marvel Comics kind of version that the public has? Do you know what I mean?
I was very aware of this because I do take a lot of free artistic choice, man. what always stuck in the back of my head was that there are still people who this is their religion, you know. So how do I make it clear that I'm building on those the old Norse myths, but I'm also, of course, I'm referencing Marvel because I know that's my readership, the fantasy readership, they're going to have the same, you know, who is Loki? Tom Hiddleston, obviously, you know. Who could possibly no one else could be Loki, you know. Like, they did a whole series about it. It's like this, there are people who still worship those gods. So, like, on the one hand, you have to be, like, super respectful. And on the other hand, it's like, how do I make it very clear that I'm not trying to be disrespectful? I'm taking certain elements and sort of, like, riffing off them. So I don't have an answer, but I was very conscious of it going into the writing. Sorry.
No, I. Like, that was a huge thing for me in my book too, to be cognizant of, like, yeah, this is still like an active religion. So I'm writing a fictional story about the deities from an active religion. So that's like an extra layer of, like, things to worry about and to be aware of.
Would you have sensitivity readers in that case?
I didn't.
I didn't because I couldn't afford it at the time. Like, you know, you have to be able to compensate people for their labor. You can't just be like, absolutely, can you read this for me?
Tell me what you think.
I mean,
you have to pay everyone who reads your book. Let me just get the calculator out. Screw it.
Sorry, I'm having major internet trouble. So, like, I'm missing, like, entire sentences. I'm so sorry.
Don't worry. Any sentences of mine you miss are probably a good thing for you.
Tim, what were you saying?
There's an indie author, self-publisher called Bjorn Larsson.
Yes, love him. Love him.
Writes, yes, he's great, and he has a so he writes obviously about Norse mythological stuff, but I think he actually is a believer. So it's like he has a very personal connection to the god Thor. And I think that's like something that I was aware of, and I was at least I had it at the back of my mind. So I'm sort of like, how can I write this so that someone who has that deep faith can see that I'm trying to be respectful, but I'm also like, I don't mean their god. But he's the only person I can think of. I don't know. Do we know anyone else?
Yeah. It's an interesting one. Like, I think personally, unless you're trying to write some kind of historical fiction with mythology elements, I usually find it's kind of inherent in that way. In my head, when I'm reading, I always find it's inherent that they're not writing about that specific god, but just an interpretation for the point of fiction. And especially with Norse mythology, I think, and Greek, Norse and Greek in particular, I think there's so much done over the decades and centuries with so many different interpretations that there truly is no one version of a god to stay true to when you try to portray them. I suppose it's just about being, just having a modicum of common sense and being respectful. And you're not taking a god and just making a laughing stock of them in a way that doesn't fit your story. So you could be writing a comedy and all of the gods could be silly. And that's, I think, to me, that's fine. I think it's all context. If it fits your story, then it's okay to a level. But that's the thing that always gets it for me. I think, yeah, there's so many representations of these types of gods. Just being respectful in its own way within the bounds of your story, I think, is kind of like the bare minimum that you can do as an author, like with anything you do.
Mm-hmm. And I think going back to what we had earlier as well, with the humor of the Norse gods, I think people who are Asatrona, who do believe in the Aesir, have more of a humor about it and are a lot more forgiving and just excited that someone else is exploring the pantheon and the gods, and that there's more content out there for the most part. But obviously, the more you get closer to actually telling myths or to actually telling real history, the more you have to put in the effort to do the research and try to get things right and really get down into it.
I was also conscious when I was writing that series of the fact that there is a significant segment of the global population that has appropriated the Norse mythology for negative purposes. And I think I was
going to bring that up. Yeah.
Yep.
I definitely wanted to make sure that I wasn't giving them any fodder for what they believed in. I wanted to portray the more accurate version of like you said, it's a thing that people still believe in, and the real thing is not a bad thing. And so that was definitely on my mind when I was writing.
Co-signed.
Yeah.
Yep.
But I was going to ask, like, a lot of, sorry.
Oh, no, please, go ahead.
But I was going to say, like, that to put this back in the context of fantasy as well, is that fantasy, I mean, this is, like, my personal approach to fantasy as a speculative fiction, is you're always in, communication, like, there's always a dialogue between, like, you as the author and the culture around you. So it's like, yes, of course, I'm telling a story about, you know, gods and heroes and magic, and I'm using all of the fantasy tropes and, you know, the epicness and the battle scenes. But what I'm actually talking about, like what I'm trying to say is, this is what the world is as I perceive it. You know, this is how I feel the culture is around me, or like this is my viewpoint, and so I think this aspect of dialogue is hopefully, you know, it's still there. It's like everything, yes, it's fantasy, but of course I'm writing in my time, and mm-hmm. you know, I'm a product of my time and my culture, so it's like I have to, you know, honor that as well.
Yeah, like fantasy, nothing exists in a vacuum. You know, even though you could be writing a historical fiction about the Viking Age or about the Norse myths, but we're still writing today, and our audience is going to have today's perspective. And I totally agree.
And to expand on that as well with the Vikings, I feel like there's so many things being discovered today in archaeology with the Vikings, so many new things that you're going to make mistakes if you try to stick very, very close to it. It's just going to happen, because in 10 years, they're going to discover something new, and, oh, it's going to shift our entire conception and idea of who the Vikings were and how they actually lived their lives. And that's just how it is. So we have to do with what we can and try to fill in the gaps the best that we can.
I'm still waiting for, like, a lost Edda to resurface. Like, it's in somebody's attic in Iceland somewhere. Like, just, you know, something, I just, like you said, like, I feel like something is going to just blow our minds one day. Like, some lost text or artifact that
so
we're just going to be like,
already with Vikings.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. But I also hate it. Because, like, once you put a book out, it's out.
Well, actually, in the indie world, you could change that stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't do it too much, because I think if you change chunks of story, it kind of defeats the purpose of what you've done. But you know, typos. What someone said a while ago, I was like, what's the biggest advantage of being an indie author? I was like, well, if I make a typo, I can fix it. Number one advantage.
What are some exciting rabbit holes you guys went down for research?
The same question as earlier, how much time do you have? Like, the shit that I have Googled.
Yeah.
Holy crap. But even I remember when I started, I spent like an hour just because, like I said, my world's kind of more Norse inspired. There's a lot in the Norse, like even like the language that I use in the world is all rooted in Old Norse and also Danish now. So I'll take a lot of my words to different parts and construct and do different pieces. But like, I spent like an hour trying to find out what types of like shovels could be around, and what would they use, and what kind of handles would they have, what they'd be made of, what would they be used to hold, would it be nails, would it be this and that, and stuff that you should not spend an hour Googling.
I did the same thing with
many rabbit holes.
I did the same thing, but with door hinges. And then those paragraphs ended up being deleted from the story anyway. So,
like, you have that. You have that knowledge now. So
if you haven't spent at least an hour researching the different ways people will use to go to the bathroom at that time, it's like, because your Norse god did not sit down on the toilet. It did not happen.
No.
And like, how often do you even bring that up in a book? But you need to look it up.
Like that's I think one of the early episodes of Norsemen on Netflix like had like a what the hell was the shitting log or something.
Yes.
That's serious, brilliant.
Yeah.
I hope lots of people watch that one.
That sounds great.
What I wanted to say was one of the things that I did actually end up with, so I was doing some research and I found like the Heimdall, as you all know from the Marvel movies, the guy in the golden armor who watches over
Idris
the
Elba.
Idris Elba, actually, yes. So he in Norse mythology has 9 mothers, and they are all named as mothers of Heimdall, and one of them is called Eisla. And as far as I could find, because I was doing research because I wanted to have, like, I want one of the mothers, because my book is about moms, and so I had, like, well, I want one of the moms of Heimdall to be in this book, just as, like, a nice in reference, so people who know Heimdall will probably get it. And so I was researching, and I found that her name either means the stormy one or the one with testicles. So I thought that was
because that's the same thing.
It's the same. And I just thought that's great, because then all of a sudden you have this whole like, but why is someone with a name like the one with testicles mentioned as a mother of Heimdall? And of course, you know, being in the culture that we are, with a lot of the LGBTQIA representation, I was like, right, I am going to do this, and
I'm kicking this.
Stuck into my book, it's like it's in there for everyone who knows the story. It's like as a wink, and I thought that was, it was such a great detail. I couldn't not include it. It's definitely going to be her.
Going off the rabbit holes for research, biggest rabbit hole I ended up in was sailing with a Viking ship.
please tell me you hired that Viking ship solely for the purpose of research.
I did not hire it. It's a Viking warship. It's the largest reconstruction in the world. And I've been on it for weeks and weeks and weeks. and that started this just as a little research. I was down at the museum. I just wanted to see the ship. I knew that they were sailing it sometimes. And I thought, maybe I could go out for a trip with them once just to see how it, it lays in the water.
Suddenly I was raiding the coast of Britain.
Suddenly I was sitting there rowing, going away from shore. How did I end up here? What happened?
I bring it on.
That was my biggest one. And it's been a great hobby ever since. I keep going back. So, yeah.
That is very cool. And slightly related, I do have a scene in the third book of my series where we're building a ship. So obviously I had to do everything I could to make that as vaguely realistic as possible without having a ship to look at or anyone to talk to. And that was a struggle, because the ships are so important. They're so, so important. You want to make sure you're doing the right thing by them as best you can. So
that's like reference. Every time I read a book and you see like a scene where someone's forging a sword, I'm just like, you brave, brave soul. Like, all you have done, you opened yourself up to somebody, one person in a million reads your book and goes, mm-mm. That's not how you build a ship.
Yes. Oh my gosh, like I feel like my entire like current project is just like a practice in being as vaguely realistic as I can, Taya, like you said, because I'm researching like a place to have the story, and all I can find about this place is from Assassin's Creed Valhalla. And so I'm like, should I just be vague about where they are? And my friend is like, yes, because the people who know will know.
If you know, you know.
Yeah.
unless I've had the time, like you were saying, Taya, you took the time to like really kind of go through and find out how you do it. Like, right. She's like, let's build a ship. Fade to black. What a nice ship.
Yes.
Because there's just like there's points where like I would love to do that. Like I'd really like to do it, and I'm kind of going, I just know. And in fairness, I haven't had anyone give out to me about anything yet, but I just know it's gonna happen.
Yeah.
I think it's gonna happen. It has to happen.
But like
actually, that's a rabbit hole. Sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you, Genevieve. I can imagine I can imagine everyone here at some point, right, depending on whether you allow horses to be in your book, has looked up how far a horse can travel in a day. And at some point has gone, can you ride double? To which the answer usually is, you will kill the horse. So,
yeah.
See, I think that was going to be my example, was literally was like, how far can a horse ride? And then I just was like, I don't really care, actually, because I have this mountain that gives people magical powers. So for all I care, the horse can go as far as I want it to.
I think there's two elements to that, and there's something that I found a while ago, which I thought two pieces of fantastic advice. And one of them was, when you introduce all these magical elements in your world, the easiest way to get anyone to accept them is, if you want somebody to accept a winged horse, you just have to explain how the saddle works. And the idea would be that if you ground it in the most simple way, if you make a saddle so realistic that the person can understand exactly how it straps around the wings, they have no problems getting on that horse and flying away. And I think when it comes to how far someone can carry a horse and what the horses can do and what things can happen and whether you can ride double or not, there's something that Brandon Sanderson said a while ago, which I've taken to calling Sanderson's rule of cool, is that sometimes outside of the realm of what's exactly possible, when you're riding, it's better for it to just be cool. When you clang two swords together, they don't make that noise. When you pull a sword from a scabbard, it doesn't rasp, because it's usually with animal skin and oil to keep the blade clean and safe and not rusty. So it doesn't make that noise, but it does make that noise because they make it in movies and everyone sees it in movies and hears it in movies. And if you don't write it in the book, it's just not as visceral. And that rule of cool really, really dominates a lot of things. So like, you go down rabbit holes and you look at things, and I think for history and gods and specifically forging of weapons and ships, and that kind of needs to be a bit more down to the nose, because there are shipbuilders who will read your book and there are blacksmiths who will read your book. But those other little aspects, you can play with them as long as it's cool.
Cool goes a long way.
Cool goes a very long way.
Yeah.
Can they ride double? No. But if you have someone in the back shooting an arrow while they're going that way and he hits a really cool shot, you can do it.
Yeah, it's like always thinking, well, Legolas rode that shield down those stairs, so I can do this.
Legolas took down like a fucking 200-foot elephant with an arrow.
Yeah.
Like, and then slid off the trunk and goes, that only counts as one.
Yeah.
One of my favorite scenes in history.
Yeah, that was such a great scene. All right. I have a language question for y'all. Did any of you elect to use kennings?
Yes and no. I started, and I had a character who talked in kennings. Mm-hmm. And basically, it was too complicated. Like, there's just no way that the modern person is going to get all of the references and going to understand everything. And I tried it, a lot of it. I tried very little of it, but it always ended up coming back to the fact that it was just going to be too much. And I was not going to spend three paragraphs after each sentence explaining what they actually said and what they meant, because that just takes you out of everything.
Just putting it in italics afterwards every time.
Yeah, exactly. So I tried it, didn't work for me. I couldn't make it fit. So,
I'm very bad at poetry. So I can appreciate it, but like, if you like, look at any of the Icelandic sagas that have poetry and kennings in them, like, there's always the little asterisk and they're explaining all of the kennings, like, in the side. I'm like, this is really taking me out, man. Like, just tell me what happened. Not that I can't appreciate it.
What notes do not work in fantasy?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it depends. I mean, Terry
Pratchett
wouldn't have a
word. Oh, yeah, but Terry Pratchett's like...
I know, but the kennings are actually interesting, because I don't know if you've read this yet, but there's a new translation of Beowulf by Maria Davana Headley.
Yes.
And I think, like, she does a really interesting thing with the language, in that she really tries to work into, like, the syntax. There's a lot of sentence structure that she then tries to retranslate into English, like modern day English, and I think she's doing, like, really interesting things. Like, I do not have that talent. I wish I wish. it was so impressive. And what I did do is I instead of using Allfather for Odin, like this is a very dumb and very simple example, but like instead of using Allfather for Odin, I often put in Valfather because he's the father of the slain, and I was sort of trying to build up to a certain plot point that I knew was coming. Mm-hmm. And I had my editor read it, and he was like, why don't you just call him Allfather? Like, I've deleted all of the Valfather because that just does not make sense. And I'm like, what's his name?
Stat.
That's his name. Yes. And, you know, it's one of his very many names, but it's like, I was like, yeah, that's... Because he said, but the reader won't know that. You can't assume that the reader knows, you know, all of the names of Odin. So, and I was like, oh.
But as long as you explain it eventually, like, readers aren't, you know, readers pick up on things. You gotta give him some credit.
Yeah. Some of them
and as long as you don't try to use all of his dozen of names, then...
Yeah. If you want a list of the names of Odin, Neil Price has them in the Viking Way. There's a lot. And yes, I have the Viking Way sitting right here.
It's probably one of the biggest fields you have to navigate when you're writing is how much do you hold someone's hand? You had it's a decision every author has to make with everything they do. Like, do you say, oh, Valfather, father of the slain, and then everyone knows? Or do you just keep it that way, play it the way you want to do, and let people get along with it? I think there's different types of readers as well. Some of them just massively prefer different ones.
And it's impossible to please everyone too. Those same people who are gonna get on you about the blacksmithing and the shipbuilding, like sometimes when you have like such specific knowledge. It can be frustrating because you're like, nobody ever gets this right in stories. But it's like, we can only do so much, you know?
I think the most fantastic example for me in history is The Wheel of Time, because it's over such a long period of time and they're released years after each other. Like, you're in like book 7 and they're explaining shit you found out in book 1. Like, you go through it and he's like, this is Lan. Lan is a warder. A warder is somebody who protects. And you're like in book 10 because he goes back and re-explains everything every single time. Like, it's really interesting. It's a decision everyone makes is how much to hold someone's hand. Because people say, those books are 1,000 pages long. I was like, yeah, but 200 of them were in the first book.
He had to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he has to. Yeah. Yeah, he did.
Because there's
been so long between books and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, you spent an entire book talking about an entire other group of people and then you forget. And,
Yeah. Mostly because there were so many and they were published over such a long time as well. I mean, such long time went by before you got the new one. Now we can read all of them in one go, and it's not going to be the same experience.
Exactly.
All 10,000 pages.
You've got to choose, right? As long as you're consistent. I think that's really the key. As long as you pick it and you go for whatever you've picked and you just stay consistent to that, I think that's the most important.
That's probably like if you're to pick one word and stick it over every single writer's door, it's consistency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I learned a really great kenning researching this question. War onion?
Okay, I don't know that one. What does that mean?
A war onion is a Damascus blade. It's a sword.
I'm definitely creating a war onion, though.
Yes. Yeah, isn't that cool?
That's amazing. Wow.
You've just done stuff to my brain now. Because I was talking to a friend of mine. There's a blogger called Library of a Viking. And he's from the Faroe Islands, and I was talking to him a while ago, and he said something about using a book to kill someone. Okay, and I went, "I'm doing it."
I
do that all the time. I'll sit down and go, "Oh no, that has to happen." And you're like, "Oh, haha, funny." I'm like, "No, I'm killing someone with a book. It's happening. So someone is taking an onion into battle, and it's going to happen." This is my war onion.
It's just so great, isn't it?
I'm gonna make you cry. Sorry. it's early and I'm bad enough as it is, so yeah.
And what do they call blood? Battle sweat. Kennings are cool.
Okay, that is cool.
Kennings are cool. Yeah,
that is very, very cool.
Like, if you know, you know.
If you know, you know. And if you don't, you're going to be very confused. What's happening now?
It's like, what is that rhyming slang?
Fighting?
The rhyming...
Like bees and honey, money.
Yes, you got it. What group?
But Kinnings is just cool.
It's like Cockney rhyming slang.
Cockney rhyming slang, yeah. Like, if you know,
see, I just have this image now of, like, two characters in a battle, and one comes up to the other one, and he's bleeding down his face. He just goes, "You're sweating." I just love that. That's so cool. Yeah. I'm going to go off on a tangent in my brain. I'll see you guys in a few minutes.
So, speaking to those who have battle scenes in your books, how did you structure your battle scenes, and what kind of research did you do into Norse culture to create those scenes? How long do I have?
Yeah.
I'm a reenactor, so I literally just asked my friends. And they told me more about weapons than
that
I ever wanted to know.
So not fair.
I consumed a lot of media around, like, mainly battles, not just kind of like Norse battles and Viking battles and things like that. I read a lot of books. There was a great book, and it was like the greatest battles in history or something, and it was like a real depiction of different battles, whether it be sieges, whether it be open field battles, whether it be small close combat battles, and just kind of understanding. I read a book as well that was more about the actual soldier on the front line, so the actual person with the sword who's charging at the other person with the sword, and not just like a telling from a general at the back kind of thing, to really kind of understand what the nitty-gritty of it was. I did a lot of that because everything I saw, especially with like Norse stuff and Viking stuff, it was really hand-to-hand. Like, I mean, I know you see people like have bows and everything, and like they do like break the shield wall and then they shoot through it and things like that, and some of the depictions, but a lot of it is just really like my face versus your face. We have these small arms and we're going to try and kill each other. So I did quite a lot of reading on that, because just the notion of it is so different from what I was brought up watching. Like, if you, Braveheart's like one of my favourite films. It's not just because I'm Scottish, I promise. But like, there's a scene where they're fighting at the Battle of Stirling. There's a scene where they're fighting at the Battle of Stirling, and they literally just have like the Scottish army and the English army, and they just charge at each other, and then it's just this weird melee of everybody just flying around and falling over, and there's no real structure to it. It just becomes like a big massive scene of people fighting each other in confusion, whereas a lot of the Viking stuff did seem very tactical, which I kind of liked, and there was always form and like function to what they were doing. So I did quite a bit of reading on that.
I enjoy those one-on-one battles more than like a huge clash of armies, just because there's always like, when you're doing like a home gong, when you're writing home gong or reading it or watching it, there's always like an emotional element of like, why are these two people fighting? And like, that is really compelling to me.
Yeah. Well,
I was just going to say, I know we're going back to like Greek stuff, but one of my favorite battles ever on a movie or anything like that was Achilles versus Hector in Troy. And it's when the two of them are like fighting just outside the gates of Troy. And it kind of goes back to what Genevieve was saying, where you understand the emotion of it. There isn't a lot going around you that's going to steal away your attention. It's just the two of them. And it's actually, to me, probably the best fight scene, like small or large, in the whole movie. So I'm definitely backing that, Genevieve. Or as you would say, sorry, co-signed.
It's an interesting one with fights, I think, like that, because there's two aspects. So you're researching, you know, tactical and utilities, the weapons and the tactics that they would use. But then also when it comes to actual fight scenes. So it's like you were saying there, I actually tend to not like... I like the individual. So for me, I imagine my fight scene, like if you have a camera and it's, if it's a battle and it's above the battle and you want to come in and out. So for me, I'll go, you see the scope of things and you make it emotional and you kind of just flash the scope of things and make it emotional. It's kind of like, I think the word is blocking. You want to find out where everything is as you're moving, but keeping it entwined around one or two people, because I think the reality is, and people will point it out because it's been a thing in the last while, is that if you just have two people, and like the Hector and Achilles battle, which is an incredible fight, but when you go to actually do it, the reality is most of those single fights with nobody around them, it doesn't last that long. Like, they killed them in like, you know, 30 seconds. So to allow you to do a fight like that, you can make it longer and make it more dramatic by scoping out and seeing things around and scoping back in. And because therefore, you know, five thrusts of an arm isn't done in 12 lines. I think that's the thing for me. I think with battles, I would say, with, like you said, Dave, you consume a lot of media. I think learning by osmosis is probably the single biggest way a lot of authors take the information in, is that you consume it and just passively. And then you research specifics. But I think a lot of that is kind of in our heads when we go to do it. I know for me it is. And obviously you said it's the same. But yeah, I think learning by osmosis is massive. A lot of the research is just specific weapons and tactics for me. But
yeah. What's interesting about the Hongang thing is that's kind of something I try to apply to all of my battle scenes, where instead of trying to make it too big and see everything from above, I'm literally just with that one person. And every person is going to experience a battle differently. Every battle is also going to be slightly different. And that kind of gives me a possibility to make every fight feels like a new fight, like something. It's not just the same sword clashing against the same axe and going back and forth again and again, because the emotions is really what drives it. And once you're very grounded with that person, with that one character, you get to experience the battle through their eyes and through their experience, yeah, and through their emotions. And that's really what's going to make it emotional as well for a reader. Otherwise, it's just action. You know, this person does that, and this hand goes there, and that arm goes there. If you don't have that emotional pull, then why are you dedicating 30 pages to it?
Mm-hmm. And it's what makes the story really sing. Like when you switch between a character who understands what they're doing, and you show the way they go through a fight, and you flash to someone who they'd have no idea what they're doing. And, you know, they lose grip on their weapon and they trip and they don't know what's happening. And that's what really shows when an author is really taking that difference between each person and how they approach something, because everyone wouldn't approach it the same.
No, the same battle is going to look completely different for the 30 people who fight it. I mean, completely different.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, that's a really good point.
For the audience, we're kind of getting low on time. I have one question left I want to ask them. So if you have any questions, ask them now, and we'll ask the panel. So my last question is, Norse culture embraced gender roles that were different than what we normally see in Western fantasy in the past. Did you write your stories to reflect these roles, or did you write characters in a way that would be more familiar to like Western audience?
I very much went with the research. So I very much went with the, you know,
the awesome, can be the awesome as well,
and they can own land, they can own things. And, you know, there are many different possibilities, and you can do whatever you want, like a bit like the Norse war, you know, just live your life.
Yep.
That's how I look at the Norse. Live your life and all
the
time. It's
part of the reason for me why I love that Norse inspiration. I think that's one of the best parts. I've said it before on another panel. I think when it comes to the gender roles in fantasy in particular, myself, I'm kind of go, oh, I have an opportunity to not do that. I have an opportunity now to write the world. It's fantasy. I want to write it the way I think it should have been, and represent that new 21st century influence. And I love that in the Norse one, when you go back to Norse mythology and Norse influence, they were already doing it. Yes, it might not be where we are, and nothing is ever perfect, but when you're writing it, you have the opportunity to do that. And it's what I've always wanted when I'm writing the book. Like, it might not always seem like a massively overt theme, but I think when you make it an overt theme, that can be more difficult. But when you just make it a neutral fact of the world, just there, it doesn't need to be discussed. The gender role isn't there. It is the same. You might naturally have some women who are more maternal and some women who aren't, and some fathers who are more paternal and some who aren't, but that's different. But in the general scope, I think, yeah, that's part of the reason why I love the Norse influence on it, is for some reason people can argue in other fantasy that a woman couldn't do that, she couldn't do this, and then all of a sudden you go to a Viking world, she pulls out an axe, stabs some guy in the head, knocks some other guy's teeth out with a shield, and you're like, oh, that's cool. Like, I don't know why, when you pick that influence, people accept it more, but like the reality is, like, she accepted it anyway.
I definitely did that when I was sort of like not even drafting this. I was just sort of imagining the story. I knew I wanted to write about mums, and I was trying to figure out what the story was. And I was just like, a Norse-inspired world just gives me that option of saying, and here's a character who is a vastly competent warrior, but she's a woman. And, you know, most people who read fantasy would buy it because, you know, you've got a Lagertha and you've got a Thorn and you've got in Marvel you've got Valkyrie, so it's not like you have to persuade the audience, yes, this is a special woman, she's one of a kind, yeah, because she's trained in the medieval school of it's like you can just drop that and say has a little bit of shield maiden training, like these are women who are very competent. Like, it's not just Eowyn who is on her horse and because she has the, you know, it's like, no, all of the women. It's like the line that Eowyn says to Aragorn in the movie, which is taken from Tolkien, where she says, the women of this country have learned long ago that even those who don't have swords can still die on them. And it's like, excellent.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I'll fantastic. Go with that.
We have a question. Oh, right. we have a question. If you write from any Norse deity's point of view, which one would you choose?
I think Loki for me, because I don't know, I like the idea of sometimes writing somebody that's a bit of a prick, if that makes sense. And I feel like you could have a lot of fun with Loki. I think there's a lot of them. I mean, I know we were talking like to what I was saying about humour and everything, but I just think there'd be a lot of like boundaries you could push with Loki.
Mm-hmm. He'd just be so much fun. I think you'd be hard pressed to not pick him if you go off the top of your head and you're not dipping down into other kind of deities and different names. The big few, you'd have so much fun with that.
It's the interesting because Loki is the one I would not pick. I would be too worried about being inside his head and knowing his plans would ruin all the chaos that he brings about. That would be my main worry in trying to write Loki.
That's a really good point. That would be quite difficult. I think you could do it, but it would be difficult.
It would be very difficult.
Because the whole point is he's a Machiavellian schemer. So, yeah, that's a really good point.
I think I would like to write Scotty.
Yes.
She's both goddess and giant, and she's like, you know, the goddess of skiing and winter and mountains and cool stuff like that. But she has a complicated kind of relationship with both the gods and other giants, and I think that puts her at an interesting point of place from a character's perspective. So I think she'd be fun.
I'm in a weird place.
Rule, conflict is everything.
Yeah.
I'm in a weird place for answering that question because my book is from the perspective of a giantess, and like I am also working on like a Scotty project, so I'm going to bow out of this question because I've done it already.
hold on. No. You can't make that reaction and then bow out. You can't go and then not and then bow out.
Why? Because I said Scotty. I'm
we'll give you a pass.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's about.
Sorry.
No, please go, Tim. Please go. It's your turn. Absolutely.
I think I'll go with. I was thinking about Zaga, so the goddess of all of the Zagas. She's like the. Not exactly muse, but she's the one who inspires the poets to write their stuff. And I just, like, I have this idea of this really great bard character, you know, she's just, like, drinks a lot and inspires people with her songs. And just, like, that would be awesome to, and I'm not very good at that, but it would be awesome to try.
Is it me or do all the cool characters have a very strong lineage in drinking?
Well, yeah.
And what's like super interesting about writing from the perspective of like a god or goddess or giantess or like one of the individuals in this mythology is that for some of them we know so little that if every single one of us could write a story about Scotty or Saga or any of these other characters, and it would be a completely different story every single time.
Yes.
Yeah. But that's also true of the ones that we know a lot about, because that's every writer is completely different and is going to approach it differently and interpret things completely differently.
Yep. There are Loki stories out there.
For
yeah, like, I think one done. Of the differences, though,
definitely has been done. I wouldn't dare try. But
like one of the differences, we do know. Obviously, you can every author will write a different story, but at least if you do like Scotty or you do something that's less up there, yeah. you have less inherent conflicts you have to pick. So like when you're Thor, Thor will always have Odin and Thor will always have Loki and you'll always have those conflicts that you're expected to have in the stories. Whereas at least when you pick a different one, you can kind of go where you want with the conflicts. You can, because if you don't know as much, you can create them. Whereas yeah. you kind of have a few preconceptions when it comes to like, I suppose the big guys or the big gals.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that note, I've got to wrap up.
Oh, and, shucks.
I know. We could seriously just keep talking. This has been an excellent panel.
Everyone here likes fighting and everyone likes drinking.
I just want to thank everybody for coming and all of our audience for watching live. Thank you very much. And if everybody could just say, you know, what they got going on right now. And say where, you know, where we can find you in the future. We'll end on that note. So Taya, if you want to go first.
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at TL Greylock. That's where I spend probably most of my social media time. Yep. Yeah. Awesome. Like I said at the beginning, I'm supposed to be working on book 3 of the Godforge Chronicles. Book 1 is an SPFBO finalist. Book 2 will be out sometime this year. That's pretty much it.
Genevieve?
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
I'm on Instagram and Twitter at Jen Gornacek. I'm much more active on Instagram. I'm currently on hiatus from Twitter to work on my next project that I can't speak about, except that it is basically an Icelandic saga fan fiction.
Cool. All right. Thor Odinson?
Yeah. I was wondering if somebody would call me on that. Everyone's just ignoring it. Everyone's like, we're not justifying that with a response. We're just going to leave it there. I'm just going to say I won, Taya, by the way. You didn't put your name down as Odin, so I took it. So my name's Ryan, not technically Thor. Currently I'm writing, I'm a bit of a glutton for punishment, so I'm trying to get 2 novels and a novella out this year, both novels above 200,000 words, which would be interesting. But I'm currently writing a novella now, which I hope to release in the next 2 or 3 months, and then I want to get book 3 of my series out in late summer, and then I'm gonna have another scramble to see if I can get the third one out by New Year's. You can find me on Twitter, which I make sarcastic comments to everyone at all times, and Instagram. I have my own website, which is cool. I always mess around with that because, you know, what better way to procrastinate than productively? So, you know, I find that's cool. So, yeah, I thumb up, but I don't know what to say. So,
Tim, go ahead.
So I'm on Twitter and Instagram, like most of us probably, at Tim Whitecastle. I also have a website that you can subscribe to my newsletter and collect your free novella. That's not about Norse mythology, but, you know.
It's free, though. And
because I am in between projects and don't really have anything to plug of my own, if I may, here's a small Norse trifecta that might interest you, and it's Lyra Wolf, Truth and Other Lies, which is an awesome Loki telling. Cat Rector, the Goddess of Nothing at All, which is the story of Sigyn. And Hannah M. Long, Hall of Smoke, who is Norse inspired. So, you know, go read those books, and when you've done that, maybe I'm finished with a new book. I don't know.
I love all of those books.
I would watch Genevieve reaction videos all day long.
So great.
Truth and Other Lies is also an audiobook, by the way, narrated by Casey Eid, aka Norse, of course. So 100% recommend. Yes.
Like, you're like the world's most natural hype man.
As long as I don't have to hype myself.
Well, it's a great start to the day.
I can write something good enough that Genevieve does that reaction. So,
is it my turn?
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
You can find me at my website, Tilda Cold Hold, or my Twitter, Cold Hold. And in terms of books, there is Northern Wrath and its sequel, Shackled Fates. And the third one's coming out at the end of the year. So yeah, that will be the end of the trilogy.
Amazing.
And Ross?
Yep, you can find me on Twitter. I actually have it in front of me because I couldn't remember my own Twitter handle. It's DWRoss8. In terms of what I have out, Ryan, if you could hold the book up, if you still have it.
Oh, yeah, here we go. What? I have my own books here, but I have my own books. I didn't hold them up once. I just don't even think.
Thanks, Ryan. So that's Cold from the North. That's book one of the Onyxborn Chronicles. Book two, The Darkest Dust is out. Think we'll have the third one out maybe this year, depending on how much sleep I get with a toddler. I don't know. And then after that, I'm going to write a Celtic Scottish inspired 10 book series. Who knows? But that's the plan. But yeah, that's where you'll find
that's
me.
That's exciting.
Sounds good, Nicole.
And I'm what's Beth you? Tabler at Beth Tabler, and I run Before We Go blog. SBF BO judge, and I am one of the editors at Grimdark magazine.
Woo! So,
yes. So,
and thank you, by the way, for hosting. That
was, yes, this thank was you. This was thank really you very much.
Oh my, yeah. Absolutely, my pleasure. This was wonderful. It was a lot of fun.